It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, secondhand clothing is not a new concept, but more and more people are interested in buying vintage or used clothing online or in person. We'll talk about the growing market for used clothing. Now, women in the United States first gained the nationwide right to vote a century ago. But not all women could exercise the rights guaranteed under the 19th Amendment. Black women in many states face the same situation as black men, with a long list of legal restrictions that effectively barred them from voting and mob violence when they tried to exercise that right. But black women continue to work to get the right to vote and to overturn racial discrimination in the years to follow, playing a crucial role in the civil rights movement. That's just one part of the story our guest tells in her new book about the leading role black women have played in American politics from the beginning of the nation. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for our guest about the role black women have historically played in the fight for civil rights? If you've been involved in these movements, or maybe you have a story from a mother, grandmother, aunt, we want to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Martha S. Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this book, of course, is part of your work as a historian, but you write in your introduction, you were inspired by women from your own family. Can you talk about their story a little bit and how they inspired you here?
That is right. I was more than halfway through researching and writing this book when I realized that I actually didn't know the stories of the women in my own family. Where had they been in 1920? Had they been able to cast their ballots? And so I wound up taking a sort of detour. I didn't tell my editor, but I did take a detour to look into some of this family history. I'm somebody who works in an office with the women in my family hanging on the wall, kind of looking over my shoulder. And I knew that many of them were descended from an enslaved woman who had lived in Danville, Kentucky in the 19th century, Nancy Bell Graves. And in 1920, indeed, my grandmother, her mother, and her mother's mother were all living and at least seemingly eligible to vote. But I didn't have as easy a time as I thought I would as a historian tracking them down. And one of the reasons was that someone like my grandmother, when she finally did tell the story of her experience with voting rights, she didn't talk about 1920 and the 19th Amendment at all. That her important touchstone in this story was the 1950s and the 1960s and the years of the modern civil rights movement. And this was really a lesson for me in what happens when you center African-American women in this story. It turns out that while the 19th Amendment may have been a milestone of sorts, you couldn't end the story there. You had to come all the way forward until the civil rights era, until finally the passage of the Voting Rights Act 45 years later in 1965.
And you begin the story, you tell, more than 100 years before the Voting Rights Act, before the 19th Amendment, I should say, I'm sorry, and found that black women have played big roles in fighting for change from the very dawn of the United States. Can you talk some about the early days?
Sure. One of my puzzles was to look at very contemporary black women political leaders, look at their ideas and ask, where did those ideas come from? And you start to pull a thread into the past. And when I did, and in particular, I was looking for the roots of the critique that black women still bring to American politics, which is a vision for American politics of a terrain without racism, a terrain without sexism. And it turns out that those ideas really do have their origins in the earliest decades of the 19th century, where black women are not yet talking expressly about political rights, not talking exactly about the vote, but are developing a political philosophy that decries the ways in which racism and sexism are keeping them from public life, keeping them from leadership, keeping them from shaping the nation going forward. That turns out to be the origins of a story that in just a few decades will turn explicitly to the question of then voting rights.
A consistent theme through a lot of the book seems to be the idea that Black women kept being asked to choose. Are you going to work for women or are you going to work for Black people? And the answer was yes, both. But that wasn't always easy. Can you talk about that challenge?
Yeah. To the contrary, Black women, as you suggest, whether it's in anti-slavery societies or civil rights organizations or in women's suffrage associations, frequently meet up with people who aim to be allies, but really ask too much of Black women. And the response by African-American women is to build their own political organizations so that, for example, by the 1890s, Black women are founding not a suffrage association, but the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. And in that organization, they can work, yes, for civil rights, and also for women's votes. And that really is the ideal political setting for the women I read about in Vanguard.
And that speaks to another theme I see in the book, that Black women keep finding places to find power, even if they're excluded from the ways people might traditionally think about power, even if they're not allowed to vote themselves. They advocate in other ways, create organizations, create newspapers, work within churches. Can you talk about that that ability to find places to work, even when they're locked out of what we think of as the corridors of power?
Sure. You know, Vanguard would have been a very short book if a pamphlet, in fact, if I had set out to only chronicle that part of our history in which Black women can fully vote. That for much of this story, too many African-American women are disenfranchised. And part of what is fascinating is that that doesn't keep them, as you suggest, from being political actors, from exerting influence in politics, but they have to find their own ways. Sometimes that means being allies to African-American men. This is certainly true after the Civil War, where Black women will expect Black men who have themselves, most of them, come to the polls for the very first time to not only heed the perspectives of women, but to cast their ballots as a community vote, representing everyone in the community. Black women, when we get to the years after the 19th Amendment, when too many of them will be still disenfranchised, especially in the American South, will, for example, come to Washington. They'll learn to use lobbying. They'll learn to use organizing. They'll learn to use political patronage in order to affect influence in the city of Washington in those critical years when the nation is recovering from the Depression. So these are all lessons, of course, in how one goes about constructing political power without access to the ballot. The most important, or I should say, perhaps better put, the most best remembered chapter in that story, of course, is the modern civil rights movement itself, where we know Black women are part of the tens of thousands of Black Americans who are going to use direct nonviolent action in an effort to force the hand of Congress, force the hand of Lyndon Johnson, and resulting in the Voting Rights Act in 1965. All of these are, if you will, facets of Black women's political repertoire. And it's only in 1965 that we can talk wholly and concertedly about political rights in a narrow sense, casting a ballot or running for office.
We're talking to Martha Jones. Her new book is Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Martha, you share so many stories of people who maybe should have been household names or I should have been more familiar with. I want to meet at least a few of them today. I'll throw a couple names at you. Mary Ann Shad Carey. She goes to, Windsor, Ontario, starts a newspaper before the Civil War, ends up recruiting for the Union Army. Can you share some of her story?
Sure. Like many of the women in Vanguard, Mary Ann Shad Carey will begin her work life, if you will, as a teacher. And she will, as you suggest, be among those Black Americans who in the 1850s, in the decade before the Civil War, are so deeply discouraged about their prospects in the United States that they migrate away. And in her case, she settles in what is today Ontario in Canada, Toronto, and London in Canada. There, she is looking for a way, as we've talked about, to not only realize her own political aspirations, but to really wield political influence even from afar. And she founds a newspaper, the Provincial Freeman. And here now she creates a platform not only for herself, but for many exiled Black Americans, including Black women. And when we go back to that paper, we can appreciate the ways in which she is, in her own way, campaigning for women's full political equality. She will come back to the United States in the era of the Civil War, recruit for the Union Army, as you suggest, and then by the 1870s, she will be settled in Washington, D.C., where she is a full-fledged suffragist, very early in that movement, and part of a, how can we put it, a confrontational wing of that movement that in the District of Columbia is going to make a concerted effort to have Congress change the laws, remove sex restrictions from voting rights. And Mary Ann Shank Carey will be a part of those broiling scenes in Washington, D.C., where women confront registrars, where they gather in large crowds, all in an effort to continue the work that she had been doing since the 1850s in Canada, which is championing the full political rights of American women, Black and white.
We're talking to Martha S. Jones right now, professor of history at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the role Black women have played in political movements throughout American history? Have you seen Black women work within these movements? How have you seen them work within those movements? If this is your story or someone in your own family, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we continue our conversation about the role Black women have played historically in advocating for civil rights in the United States. Our guest is Martha S. Jones, professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, author of the book Vanguard: How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Martha, I want to meet another figure in your book, a powerful figure, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. A quote that struck me, she's speaking at the Equal Rights Association in, I think, 1866. The quote, "You white women speak of rights, I speak of wrongs," and highlighting some of the differences that she wanted to advocate for, not choosing between advocating for just women or just for Black people. Can you introduce us to her?
Sure. Another former teacher, a poet, and a seasoned anti-slavery lecturer by the time in 1866, she joins the Equal Rights Association, coming together with an old radical coalition of women's rights advocates and abolitionists to think about the future, a future where slavery is behind them, where the prospect of citizenship and full civil rights is right on the horizon. And the question for this coalition is, who will enjoy voting rights, by what terms? And Watkins Harper knows that this coalition is in danger of fracturing between those who are advocating, on the one hand, that African-American men should go first and be among the first to win new voting rights in this climate, and those who insist that women, in particular white middle-class women, should be among the first now to enjoy new citizenship rights in the wake of the Civil War and the rewriting of the Constitution. Watkins Harper isn't having it, if you will, because, of course, this, as you suggested earlier, requires her to choose, right? And she sees herself and understands her political position as both that of a woman and of a Black American. And she challenges everybody in that meeting, if you will, to a higher vision, one that is not a politics that is fractured by the fact of race or the fact of sex. The line I love from her remarks is this one. She says, "We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity." And at this moment, Watkins Harper is really charting out a new vision for Black women's politics, one that she will champion the rest of her life, but one that will really take hold among and between Black women who understand that their political power, their political possibilities are not merely the fulfillment of individual or even group goals, but really are intended and must be put to the purpose of what today we would call human rights. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper sets the bar very high in 1866 and challenges people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass to meet that challenge.
And that leads to a slogan adopted by one of the national groups you write about. You adopted as one of your own chapter titles, "Lifting as We Climb." And this is another theme in your book, that Black women are advancing human rights for all. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The National Association of Colored Women is founded in 1896 out of this vision. And it is an organization that by the beginning of the First World War, will include 300,000 Black women organized across the country under the auspices of this national organization. "Lifting as We Climb" is a philosophy, right, that says some of us may have had the advantage and the possibility, say, of education. Some of us may have had the advantage or the possibility of a vocation like teaching. But the role of this organization is to bring all women on board, to move all women forward. And in the case of the NACW, that means, yes, working toward women's suffrage, right? Women's voting rights and the road to the 19th Amendment. And at the same time, for example, championing anti-lynching legislation, which is one of the signature causes of the NACW. So "Lifting as We Climb," yes, speaks to the concerns of women, but it acknowledges that Black women's concerns extend far beyond questions of sex.
One more name I want to throw in here to talk about how long it took from 1920 and the 19th Amendment to many Black women celebrating their first vote: Jo Ella Moore in 1965, casting her first vote at age 70. Can you talk about her story and that significance?
You know, Jo Ella Moore, and I hope you had a chance to see the wonderful portrait of her that is in Vanguard, because this is how I first met her, in a museum exhibition, where a photograph of her with her arm lifted, taking that oath that finally after seven attempts, she is able to, in 1965, in the wake of the Voting Rights Act, join the voter rolls in Prentiss, Mississippi. This is a story about the kind of fortitude that it takes, and how the work of Black women to win full voting rights is a project that extends out across generations. But what we know undergirds Jo Ella Moore's raised hand is a great deal of risk, is a great deal of sacrifice, is a great deal of violence that women like she and others have had to endure in order to, if you will, enjoy the fruits of their labor and finally have their names added to the voters' rolls.
You share so many names and stories of people you're able to find in archives and photos and more. At one point in talking about the civil rights movement, you talk about all the women whose, you know, names are never going to be out there in the public, maybe just in family legend. What do you think about that legacy of so many women who probably did a lot of work, maybe at the local level, that we don't have that paper trail for anymore?
Yeah, you know, in Vanguard, I've tried to chronicle many women, some of them well-known, some of them whose names you might be learning for the first time. But you're right to point out that running through this story are many women whose names I even don't have the opportunity to invoke. And I hope that Vanguard is a conversation starter, whether it's in your family or in your church community, in your club, or in your book group. I hope that Vanguard is the place where you might start to ask questions about the women in your own family, like I did, about the women in your community, the history of your community, and the story of women's voting rights, that there are so many histories still to be recovered, to be told, to be written. And I hope that in that sense, Vanguard is just the beginning of a new chapter in the telling of how Black women have come to power and how they have used political power over a very long history.
In our last minute and a half or so, you write in your conclusion that a lot of Black women leaders of today are in fact very conscious of the history you share and see themselves as standing on the shoulders of the people you're writing about.
Kamala Harris in August of 2020 accepted the Democratic nomination. She invoked the names of six women. I'll quickly tick them. Mary Church Terrell, Ida B. Wells, Mary McLeod Bethune, Fannie Lou Hamer, Diane Nash, and Constance Baker Motley. Our time won't permit me to offer up the biographies of those women, but I will say that I think now Vice President-elect Harris has given us all homework and the responsibility to learn this other chapter in the nation's political history, learn who the founders are for her political career, the women on whose shoulders she stands. And I hope folks will know those names before too long in this new political moment.
Martha, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Martha S. Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. She joined us to talk about her latest book. It's called Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. For a long time, fashion and clothing purchases were driven by whatever was the next and newest big thing, like fast fashion by brands like H&M. But that seems to be changing. A lot of consumers are embracing used secondhand clothes. In some cases, it's considered to be superior to some of the new options at the stores. Secondhand fashion is predicted to grow by 185% in the next 10 years. Fast fashion only 20%, according to at least one retail analyst. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you buy clothing secondhand? Do you like to find it thrifting online through a vintage shop or something different? What draws you to shopping secondhand? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nancy Murray is the Academic Director for the Kohl's Center for Retailing Excellence and a Teaching Professor of Retail in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison. She's worked in the retail industry in buying, inventory planning, and product development. Professor Nancy Murray joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, when I think secondhand, it could be anything from, you know, you're digging through a big box and stuffing a bag, or it could be a real high-end vintage store. Is there one working definition that covers what we mean by secondhand fashion?
Well, really, secondhand is many different things. A resale retailer is one that sells anything that's previously owned. And these can be both in for-profit or not-for-profit charitable businesses. They might operate as thrift stores, they might operate as resale stores, or even consignment stores. They can range from low end or to high end. The for-profit businesses could be brick and mortar retailers, but the trend that we're really seeing right now is the online platforms that are for-profit. And these are referred to in the resale segment as a resale for the consumers. So definitely that is the trend that's happening right now, is that online segment.
I mentioned some analysis that shows maybe a boom on the way in secondhand clothing one way or another. Are you seeing that? Are people really getting into secondhand or used clothing?
Definitely. And more so in the for-profit resale segment, that's expected to grow faster than the traditional thrift or donation sector in the next few years. Currently, the traditional thrift and donation retail stores like the Goodwills and the St. Vinny's That makes up about 75% of resale, but it's projected that the next few years there will be a dramatic shift with the for-profit resale stores becoming over 50% of the total resale businesses.
What's driving this?
Well, there's a lot of different things, and any time that there's a big consumer shift, we want to look at both the economic, the cultural, and the societal influences. And we actually have all three of these influencing the secondhand market right now. Economically, the secondhand is definitely more affordable for our consumers today, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. And whenever there's economic uncertainty, more consumers will tend to shop thrift or secondhand. However, secondhand is more likely to continue through this big behavioral change that will last beyond just this economic uncertainty. Consumers are also seeing the benefit of buying better produced goods than that fast fashion. And during that stay-at-home mandate that we've been seeing, people went on a clean-out frenzy. Some utilize this as an opportunity to make some money selling their products. So many secondhand products suddenly became more available in the marketplace as well. But even before this current pandemic, secondhand products were trendy. But it's now fueled by people just not spending as much money on travel or experiences because they can't. And they're spending more money on things for their home, and because they're spending more time at home. And people are realizing that they don't need as much clothing, and they're donating their unwanted items at the same time. They also have an affinity for the good old days when vintage and retro items were maybe a little bit more fun, and they're being attracted to that. And of course, we have the passion and the priority that consumers have to be eco-friendly, and they're seeing secondhand retailing as a way to celebrate that. And secondhand shopping makes people feel good. They're truly making a difference by being earth conscious. A recent study found that consumers feel almost as good about buying secondhand as they do about adopting a puppy.
Wow, that's big. We're talking to Nancy Murray,
Right.
professor in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison, looking at rising interest in secondhand clothes shopping, thrifting or vintage or online, you name it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences and your questions. Let's go to a caller now. Bonnie is with us in Waukesha. Bonnie, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah,
Good.
I love secondhand clothes. You know, all the reasons that she mentioned above to save the money, they're often made better. And I don't want to be walking down the street and see someone who's dressed just like me. I mean, we can all go to any of the big box stores and buy the same thing, and you're walking down the street and it's like, oh, I see they stopped at store XYZ, and oh, I can see that they went to big box store number one. Because we have the exact same thing on. If you go to the secondhand store, you have a way to create your own look and save so much money and get better quality. And I'm very lucky in the fact that I can alter things and change things. And I'm not a small person, but I can find stuff that has a lot of fabric to it and recreate it into my own design. It's like, yeah, I am not a size 10, but some of these gathered skirts, once you take the elastic off, it's like, yeah, I can make a size 16 or 18 skirt out of that. And save a lot of money.
Bonnie, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Bonnie pointing out, hey, you could really set up your own style with thrifting or buying secondhand. Is that part of the motivation, do you think?
Oh, definitely. Bonnie is spot on. Repurposed items have been a trend. And just taking products and reinventing them into something else, retailers are starting to do this now as well because they've been seeing consumers do this. And when the retailer can also provide the backstory of where that product came from originally or where that fabric came from, that makes it even extra special to the consumer because it creates a unique product and it gives that consumer a connection to something that's more meaningful.
Thanks again for the call, Bonnie. We'll go to Ben now with us in Chippewa Falls. Ben, hi.
Hi, Brian. Love your show. I'm a longtime listener. As I'm calling you right now, I'm actually sitting in the parking lot in the Goodwill in Lake Halley, Wisconsin, about to go inside and do exactly what you're talking about. I love secondhand just about everything. I'm actually sitting in my secondhand Jeep right now. You can save so much money. All of my work clothes comes from Goodwill because I can ruin it. I work in manufacturing, and it's okay. I paid $3 for this pair of pants. You can find the most unique things, and there's just so much of it out there that's just so affordable. We just need to learn how to share a little bit better and just disperse all these things between us. We don't have to manufacture so much clothes all the time. Thank you so much.
Oh, wait, day. Ben, I got to ask, are you on the hunt for something in particular when you head into the store today, or do you just, you know, whatever's looking good at a good price?
You know, well, I actually do this almost every Monday. I just look for what's new. You know, they replenish their supply just about every week or so. And so I go in and just look for things that appeal to me. And I really have a growing flannel shirt collection. and that's part of why I do it. You know, it's so affordable. And, you know, I'm not a guy who makes a ton of money. So I haven't bought retail clothing in probably 15 years.
Fantastic, Ben. Thank you so much for the call. Well, Ben was saying somewhat you were saying there, economics driving it, but also some style. And, hey, who cares if that $3 shirt gets wrecked at work?
And Ben's like many consumers that they consider secondhand clothing or shopping the thrift stores as a treasure hunt. And some even look at it as an investment. A lot of the young consumer, the Gen Z consumers, are doing fashion flipping where they buy something and then resell it on their social media after they maybe wear it and get their picture on Instagram.
Thanks for the call, Ben, at 800-642-1234. Nancy Murray is with us, teaching professor of retail in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison. We're talking about the growing popularity of secondhand clothing, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed this gaining popularity lately, or have you been a long-time secondhand shopper yourself? Are you a reseller online or in a store, a vintage store maybe? Also like to hear from you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Nancy Murray, teaching professor of retail in UW-Madison's Consumer Science Department, talking about the growing popularity of secondhand clothing through thrift stores and online resellers. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Heidi joins us in Eau Claire. Heidi, hello.
Hello.
Oh, what'd you want to tell us about Heidi?
Well, I just like to comment on the nostalgia value and also the quality of older clothing. I have four beautiful silk dresses from the 1920s, flapper style, from a family friend who passed away and worked in a dress shop near Chicago. One of them is a beautiful three-layer georgette silk evening dress with glass beads. And of course, they didn't have zippers in those in the clothing at the time. So it was all these tiny hooks and snaps up the side of the dress to get into it. Then I have my aunt's écru lace wedding dress suit from the 1950s, 1957. Wow. And I have had so much fun wearing these vintage items and had so many compliments when I do wear them when I'm going out and about. And then the other thing that I have are numerous suits and dresses with International Ladies Garment Workers Union labels in them from the 1980s when I first started to work professionally. So there I'm showing my age. But they are so well made, beautiful wool jersey, silk dresses, you know, raw silk, things that you just can't find in the store anymore. So I like to look at used clothing stores for items like that.
Heidi, thank you so much for sharing it. And let's key in, Nancy Murray, on that that durability question. People point at fast fashion as kind of the opposite of what Heidi was just talking about. People aren't going to be wearing this stuff in, 2120 because it won't last that long. Compare and contrast for us.
That's right. A lot of the fast fashion items are only meant to last about three washings. So definitely Heidi's items have lasted long beyond that. And so I'm sure those are great conversational pieces when she's out socializing.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Lynn next in Appleton. Lynn, hello.
Hi. I've been going to thrift stores for decades. I go for
two specific reasons. One is for jeans because they're cheap and already broken in. And the second is I'm a costumer. And you can find pretty much any element of a costume you want. If I'm not sewing it, I will throw something together from a thrift store. But they also will have, usually they'll have racks of like sheets and tablecloths and curtains that are some pretty, really interesting fabrics that you can get really cheap at a thrift store too. So I have many, many thrift store costumes in my collection.
Fantastic. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that. I assume that's not necessarily driving the secondhand market, though, the costumers out there. But those broken-in jeans, I think, probably have a lot of appeal, don't they? Nancy Murray.
Oh, yes, definitely. Customers really that are shopping secondhand often are looking for some just basic items. But as we mentioned earlier, they're really looking for that treasure hunt. But, you know, if everyone bought just one secondhand apparel item and said, instead of something new, we would save about 25 billion gallons of water each year and lessen the carbon dioxide equivalent of almost 6 billion pounds and less than 450 million pounds of waste. That's if everyone just bought one secondhand item instead of a new item each year. So it can really be make a big impact on the environment.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ruth joins us next in Madison. Ruth, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to share with you about this beautiful vintage German wool hooded cape I recently purchased online. I have German-Hungarian lineage, and it was such a treat to find this cape that is probably from the 1950s, I would say, 1960s, when capes were really popular. I'm just a big fan of natural fiber, and I find that here in our northern climate, it's extremely difficult to find natural fiber that is reasonably priced. Wool or cottons are very expensive here, so buying vintage and then buying cotton and wool products online is definitely the way I like to go. Synthetics, they just feel too weird to me. Thanks,
and Ruth,
Nancy.
Is that a vintage wool cape part of your winter repertoire now?
Absolutely. I wore it the other day with a pair of boots, and I felt suited and booted. This girl is ready to go.
Fantastic, Ruth. Professor Murray, in just our last minute or so, could you talk about that opportunity to find that unique item that you're not going to just find on a store shelf, at least not in an affordable way?
Well, right. The new resale retail stores, the one that are for profit, those people are great at curating the best products for their customers. So for those that maybe don't have the time or the energy or the patience to go through a Goodwill or a St. Vinny's to find that item, the resale stores have already done that for you. And they are so much more enjoyable. The ambiance is so much better and the merchandising is so much better today. And that's why we're expecting to see those resale stores grow in popularity and grow in overall retail sales in the next few years.
Thanks for that call. Enjoy that cape. And Professor Murray, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nancy Murray is the Academic Director for the Kohl's Center for Retailing Excellence and Teaching Professor of Retail in the Consumer Science Department at UW-Madison. She's worked in the retail industry in buying, inventory planning, and product development. For tens of thousands of students in Wisconsin, their first full semester in college has been characterized by dorm quarantines at their schools, waiting on the results of COVID-19 tests, and a whole lot of social isolation. Rich Kramer reports on how some of these first-year students have found a sense of community and the mental health risks the pandemic poses to young people.
When Mackenzie Miner moved to UW-Eau Claire's campus in August, she hoped her first year in college would bring lots of new social connections. Instead, she says spikes of COVID-19 and quarantines of multiple dorms left her leery of fellow students at the beginning of the semester.
So it was like, oh my God, I'm like sharing a bathroom with all these people where I literally like don't know where they've been. Like that sounds awful, but like it's like weird. I don't know.
Miner's dorm was never quarantined, and she says those anxieties faded with time. For her, college life has meant takeout meals in her room and online classes on her laptop. She was tested for coronavirus every other week and lived with heavy social restrictions. Miner says older students in her band classes have reminded her of how unusual this semester has been.
And they talk about it like, oh, we used to go do this when we could all be together and like stuff like that. So like there's like that little taste of like, that's what normal was supposed to feel like.
UW-Milwaukee freshman Amanda Holzer thought about canceling her dorm contract, but ultimately took the plunge and moved to the campus of more than 24,000 students. She says it was really intense, knowing it would be hard to visit home once the semester started. As it draws to a close, Holzer says she's starting to feel a sense of community on campus.
It's just been difficult, like, because obviously I can't just, like, go to class and meet people in class. Most of my classes are online. And like a couple of them are actually like pre-recorded lectures. So I actually don't know who's in my class at all.
The decision by the UW system and other Wisconsin colleges to bring students back to campus this fall was criticized by those who said it would inevitably lead to more COVID-19 infections. Early in the semester, photos circulated on social media of crowded campus bars in places like Madison and Eau Claire. For many students, being on campus felt like an important part of their college experience, even if that meant living with pandemic restrictions. But for some, the pressure of being separated from their peers has taken a toll. Sandra Cox is the director of the Student Counseling Center at UW Oshkosh. She says they've been seeing a student in crisis every hour. And Cox says students with very different histories are feeling the effects.
If somebody already had a tendency towards struggling with anxiety or depression, we were seeing that the pandemic was bringing an increase to that. But the uniqueness that we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of students who never experienced any of these symptoms in their life prior to this pandemic experience.
A study at Texas A&M University found more than two-thirds of students surveyed there reported increased anxiety this semester. Nearly half reported symptoms of depression. Researcher Farzan Sasangohar says almost 90% of students that were interviewed said the pandemic has increased their feelings of isolation.
Over half of those said their interaction levels with friends has decreased, and that's a major stressor.
Robin George is a first-year student at UW-Madison. She's felt socially isolated at times. She says her advice to incoming students this spring is to leave the dorm at least once a day.
I've had weeks where it's like school is stressful and you just want to stay inside and it's just not a good mental health situation. So making sure that you're still getting outside and making social interactions, get involved with extracurriculars, that's a good way to meet people.
The students say they appreciate the COVID-19 precautions their universities have taken, and they've still found ways to forge social connections. At UW-Milwaukee, Amanda Holzer says she and her suite mates text each other the results of their COVID-19 tests every week. That's not something earlier classes of college students had to worry about, but they want to know that everyone is healthy. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.